So finding a way to settle in to your posture. Again, something that's upright but very relaxed. So as we're going into a metta, a loving-kindness meditation, start by being very kind to yourself, by finding that posture which is stable, sweet, one you can relax into. And setting motivation, touching in on your own sincerity with this practice. Let me see if you can find that sense in your own heart of desiring to touch and awaken your loving heart energy in your own feeling or your own words, however it reveals itself to you, however you can contact and connect with that. And we settle into stillness and into loving kindness through relaxation. So take a moment to scan through your body and see if there's any place that is tightened in the last hours or today, or even in the last few moments. A place of tightness, tension, or maybe even some pain. And first of all, note it. And then if you wish, invite your breath to flow into the very center of it, feeling the warm breath flowing into it, contacting that sense of tension. And you can invite it or allow it to release on the exhalation, or just allow the breath to guide you to be more present with it in a felt sense. So one level of loving kindness is the very body itself, allowing this body to come into a state of ease. And one way of working with this is often the image of a smile. It's used to help settle the very nervous system. So imagine a smile around us, the sky around us, filled with an image or filled with the curve of a smile. The sky filled with the curve of a smile that extends up the sky into the heavens. the smile, the curve, the warmth, filling your heart mind. Letting that smile begin to extend into your eyes. Feeling the smile reaching your eyes. Maybe feeling the corners of your eyes turning up slightly, lifting. Seeing if it's possible to allow the eyes to relax into that felt warmth of the smile. Allowing your eyes to be like orbs floating in a warm pool of water. Begin to allow the smile, that felt sense of a smile, to come into your mouth. Maybe feeling a slight smile turning up the corners of your mouth. Thich Nhat Hanh called this smiling yoga. Allowing even the inside of the mouth to smile, allowing the jaw to relax and release. And smiling through the mouth, jaw, and eyes together, feeling the warm curve of a smile. Though it's not so much an image, but using that as a felt sense. Allowing your whole face, your head, to be filled with the warmth of a smile. And smiling into your heart area, feeling the curve and warmth of the smile. And that curve and warmth of the smile begins to spread through your chest, through your heart. And then begin to see if you can feel the smile, the curve and warmth of the smile begin to come from the inside out, from deep within a cellular level in your heart space. Feeling your way into that deep space within your heart and the warm curve of a smile gently, sweetly emerging. And then beginning to spread up through your upper torso. Maybe into your upper shoulders, through your arms, through your lungs, through your back. Now feel the warm curve of a smile in your navel center. And the warm curve of the smile in your navel center begins to extend, to spread out through your whole lower torso. Smiling all the way into your sit bones. And I invite you to take your hands and place them on your heart center. And see if you can be inside your heart center, feeling the warmth of a smile radiating from your hands into your heart. It's as if you're receiving a warm, curving smile from your hands, but your hands are not your own. It's that you're feeling your heart receiving that warmth, that loving warmth. You might experiment with changing up the pressure a little bit so that your heart and chest feels that sense of being communicated with, of being contacted, connected. So this is a felt sense, a visceral feeling from the inside of a loving presence and a tenderness. And if you feel moved to add words, you may allow the words to melt into your heart center. May I feel safe. May I feel held in loving presence. May I feel filled with a loving presence. Or simply being your heart, feeling the flow of that loving presence coming from your hands, flowing in, filling you. And then returning your hands, releasing your heart. And allowing yourself just to note how you feel now. How is your body and mind? As a whole. And then releasing the meditation gently as you're ready, allowing movement to come back in and opening your eyes. So, welcome everyone. That was a different way of doing the loving kindness meditation. How was it? Did it work for to bring a sense more of the visceral feelings? And for some people it will work. Some people are more verbal and they'll hear it and that will trigger something. So it's this way that, again, we've really been talking about access, right? And so I'd like to, first of all, start by having everyone turn around and introduce yourself to someone who's nearby, hopefully that you don't know or don't know well. Or...
Hi, Bob. What's your name?
Okay, so we are. I like the foot action there, Jay. I like that foot action. You've got it down. I'm not even reaching down anymore. We need to get you one of those things where you can sit there.
You
know.
It's got the toe going on.
We got the toe going on. The toe action.
I'm doing it with my arm.
Oh, that's it. Well, we all bow down to the one who has reached the cities. So we're talking about the Brahma Viharas, otherwise known as the Four Immeasurables, which are immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, or karuna, immeasurable joy, or mudita, and immeasurable equanimity, which is upeksha. Right? And we talked a little bit about these being in the very early sutras of and of the Buddha. And I hope I get to eventually actually get to the story where he first talks about it and brings them up. And the practice itself is, may all mother sentient beings, or may all beings, have happiness in its causes. This again is the Tibetan version. May all mother sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all mother sentient beings never be separated from the bliss that knows no suffering. And may all mother sentient beings dwell in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and aversion. So that's our starting point. That's the practice as it's done in its earliest form, except it's not early if you have mother sentient beings in there. The mother sentient beings is the Tibetan version. And as I said, we'll talk about that in the last class. Like, why that difference? What is that about? What does that mean? And this week, we are supposed to be working, I think, with compassion. But I got confused. And it didn't occur to me till I was like packing up that I think I mixed up my weeks and thought we had an extra week for metta. So we're going to do metta today. but metta is loving, like immeasurable love, right? Metta or maitri. And this is that sense that may all sentient beings, may all mother sentient beings have happiness in its causes. And the Buddha said in the Metta Sutta, like a caring mother holding and guarding the life of her only child, so with a boundless heart of loving kindness, hold yourself and all living beings as your beloved children. So that's the practice of love. We have, so I wondered, first of all, to start, what stayed with you, if anything, from last week when we started talking about loving kindness in Maitri? And what we started talking about last week, most of all, was loving kindness towards ourselves. What do they call it? Technical break? Excellent. So, what do you remember from last? Like, what landed? What do you just remember that we talked about, or what stayed with you this week? What's that?
We can give what we don't have.
We can't give what we don't have. Thank you. And if we don't have ink, we can't give writing. Sweet. It's a really sweet way to put it.
We were exploring the ways that we could evoke sense of feelings of love and kindness.
Well, we were exploring the ways we could evoke a sense of loving kindness. Anything else?
We talked about something in small groups, and there was a picture of a sea anemone.
Right. We talked about something in small groups, and there was a sea anemone.
That was the homework for the other week.
Why would we have a sea anemone up?
Mm-hmm.
Open heart or closed heart.
Open heart or closed heart, right. Like, is our, what, when does our heart open and when does our heart close?
Yeah, I was thinking, when you have that image, that does that mean when I open my heart, am I going to get spit at or something?
Oh, no.
Yes, blood will come.
Cool. And any questions that came up over the week or from last week?
Do you think this practice works even if you're not feeling close towards someone, but you know, like if you think you're feeling fine, but you want to work with,
yeah.
I don't know if this makes sense, but will it do something even if it's not like strongly charged feeling?
So if you're doing it towards someone who, yes, it will. And it's a great question. We'll go into it more today. Okay, so thank you.
I remember there was like difficulty around feeling.
Uh-huh.
We did the meditation at the end towards the imaginary object and then the real, and there was like
the self,
a spectrum of being able to generate loving kindness, being able to not do it, and then really being able to do it.
Great. So awesome. Thank you.
I'm going to write that.
It's my own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't, I'm going to start at the top there while Ryan finishes. We can't give what we don't have, right? So, self-love. This is where traditionally we start, with self-love. And what I noticed last week was, to me, it felt like there was a lot of emotion in the room. And I really wanted to just name that. It was like a lot of times we'll have a class and a course, and we're talking more about conceptual things and things that we're going to put into our life. But it felt to me like we got into a very deeply emotional level last week. And it could feel different. And so the Buddha said, you yourself as much as anybody else in the entire world deserve your love and compassion. Or the way he really said this in the sutra, the more direct translation, is that you can search through the whole universe for someone more deserving of your loving love and affection or your own loving kindness than yourself. So in other words, you can look through the whole universe trying to find someone else that's more deserving than you are. And that person is not to be found anywhere. Mm-hmm. Right? You yourself, as much as anyone in the entire universe, are deserving of your own loving kindness, sometimes translated as your own love and affection. So I like that image, that you can search in the whole universe and not find someone more deserving. And I want to mention and cycle back to why I think part of there was this emotion in the room, as we brought up this thing that as we start to work with and practice metta, or loving kindness towards ourselves, in our culture anyway, we often encounter this level of self-aversion that is almost sometimes unbearable. Like it's almost the opposite. We start with, I'm going to love myself. I'm going to start sending myself loving kindness. And honestly, what happens is we start just coming up against our own hard heart towards ourselves, right? And we talked about that. And to be really straightforward, that's an obstacle to awakening. That's an obstacle to really being able to practice the loving kindness in its fullness, I mean, metta and the four immeasurables in its kindness. Because we're leaving someone out. And who's that someone?
Yourself.
Yeah, the finger pointing back here. So we really have to pay attention to that self-aversion, to that self-criticism, to that self, whatever, I mean, people have different words, you know, self-loathing, self-unworthiness. And what happens is we become so habituated to it, we don't even notice it. Like I mentioned last time, someone said that sense of self-worth, lack of self-worth, has become the very air that I breathe. Right? And Tara Brach, we talked about how she calls it the trance of unworthiness, and I like that because it's like being asleep. We're sleepwalking. We're in this trance. We're caught by this idea. But it's not just an idea. It's this visceral felt reality in the core of our being. And we just walk around feeling bad about ourselves, and then our whole life becomes a strategy of how do I avoid actually touching in and feeling that feeling, right? Or how do I make up for it? That's something that feels like it's lacking. Like, if I really work hard and sing and dance fast enough, everyone's going to finally, like, give me whatever it is that makes me feel good about myself, and I'll feel validated in the world. And so we run ourselves ragged for this outside approval that will never actually land, because it isn't there to be touched in ourselves yet. Does anyone relate to this? Huh? So we need a lot of tools for this. And the class, sadly, is really too short for me to go over all the tools. You know, we need to do a retreat. And someone was suggesting, I mentioned that, and they said, hey, we've got the stuff here because we got blankets and we got pillows. Let's just all stay and do a retreat and cozy up. I was like, yeah, okay, let's do it.
We'll bring the camp stove.
We'll bring the camp stove. We can have a week-long sleepover.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, as you could feel again in the room, when we start working with the emotional level, it can start to get tender and raw and intense and vulnerable. And we can start to feel overwhelmed or lost in it, and so we need to learn how to navigate through it. So what I wanted to say kind of in brief is, first of all, that it works. This practices and the tools work, and even the deepest sense of self-loathing and lack of self-worth can and will change. And it's really important work to do. I remember this woman whose mom was dying, and her mom said, you know, all my life I thought something was wrong with me. What a waste. We don't want to waste our precious life that way, feeling like something is wrong with us. And like, it says right up the top there, we can't give what we don't have, right? So it's also a waste, because I like to say that we not only have a right to feel basically, get in touch with our basic goodness and feel a sense of genuine happiness, but we have a responsibility, because that's what the world needs. The world needs a wise, loving, happy heart. We need that desperately, right? More and more. So as we do this practice, besides self, this, what I've been calling self-loathing tonight, or that lack of self-esteem, whatever we want to call it, something missing, we can also just uncover a lot of emotion, right? A lot of different emotions as we do these four immeasurable practices. And why is that? Like, sometimes I was thinking, it's very much like when you first sit down and meditate, I've had people say, I don't like to do meditation. It makes my mind crazy. It's like I have all these uncontrolled thoughts. I'm like, you know what? I hate to break it to you, but you always have those uncontrolled thoughts. You just don't notice them, right? So it's similar on the emotional level. We walk around busy and frozen, and we don't actually notice the emotions that are arising. We're out of touch with them, literally. And, or we've repressed them or dammed them up because they feel like if they come out, they're going to be overwhelming, and I don't know how to navigate them, and they're going to make me feel like I might even behave in a way that's like totally embarrassing or hurtful or whatever. You know, we have all these feelings about our feelings, And what happens when we're frozen and they start to melt, or we've dammed them up and there's a little chink starting to open, is it can start to feel like we're going to be flooded. Like this whole flood of emotions comes out. And that's just, again, hard to sometimes navigate. It's like, how do I just sit with all this emotion that's coming up? And then they start getting stronger because they're clamoring. They're like they're like little kids that have been ignored. And they're saying, hey, you're finally here and paying attention to me. And I want attention, and I want attention, and hey, I'm over here, and I want your attention, too. And it's just because they've been ignored and pushed down, and we're finally giving them a little space. Right? So one thing that I want to say is there are meditation tools. There's also a lot of just good, basic Western psychological tools out there, and I think it's not... I always like to say, if that really starts coming up in your meditation, look for a good counselor, someone who works with people who meditate is the best. Because often we just need more support to go through them if we really dive and delve into this. Like, you could pick up this meditation practice, this loving kindness practice towards yourself, probably for a good long time, right? And then balance it out and move on with other people and with all of it. But this could be, just doing the four immeasurables could be your practice for years. And for some people, it is their basic, primary, foundational practice. It's good enough, you know? We always like the new, fancy version of things, but you know, you could just stay here for a long time and it would be good. So does that make sense? No? Any thoughts or questions on that? A little bit?
Sometimes it's really hard to find motivation to do that when it's for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We work so much for other people, for your family, for your kids, for your work, that when it's for yourself, it's like, what do I do now?
Yeah, so finding the motivation. I think you said it, actually. It's that memory, the motivation is, right now I feel like I could keep working for everyone else, but I could become like a teapot that doesn't get filled up again. Or the tea kettle, maybe we should say. It doesn't get filled up with water again. So if I can't give what I don't have, ultimately. So by taking care of this time to do loving kindness meditation for myself, I'm actually creating the ability to continue to give to everyone else.
I think there is this obstacle to work on your self-worth. You also have to believe that you're worthy of it.
Mm-hmm.
So even get to that point, you're like, well, why would I work on me? There's like all these people who have it worse than me, or you know, there's like other people who need it more than I do. And so it's like even that is hard to...
Yeah, and I think it just keeps coming back to a version of the same thing, which is we do things for other people that we don't do for ourselves. And the only way that I know, or maybe there are other ways I know, but the way that's coming to mind now is really to do it for other people. Like, this is what I do. I go, you know what? I really feel like I don't have meditation time this morning. I've got this email and this person is waiting to hear from me. I mean, this is what goes on, and it's all for other people, and you know, I want to do this for my daughter, and I've got this to-do list, and I love taking care of them all. And then I think, but what I don't have the ability at this point in my life to have the reach and capacity to take care of all the people I want. And even to take care of the people I love, to do it really well and skillfully. So if I sit down and do my meditation, and planting the seeds and doing what I need to do to increase my capacity to take care of other people. Does that make sense, or it doesn't
totally
quite get...
It totally makes sense, and I also very aware of the, like, I hear you and I believe you, but I don't quite believe it, because I've had many years of practice, like we all have through a lifetime, of, if I'll just throw myself into service of others,
uh-huh.
That will be enough, and it will be good. And then you just, you know, pick up the speed, and you do more and bigger. And so kind of rewind from that to show up there, I actually have to show up for me first.
Right.
It's like I'm learning
years of.
Yeah. So why do you run around and take care of other people?
Because it's easier than do it for myself.
Because it's easier.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's a selfish motivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, I thought of it as the opposite, though. I was thinking, you know, how do you balance it out with this self-cherishing? You know,
mm-hmm.
how do you practice loving kindness and not have it turn into self-cherishing? Because, I mean, I grew up Catholic. And sort
uh-huh.
of, it was
mm-hmm.
constant, you know, you have to be thinking of the least of you, not yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Never, ever, ever. So it's just ingrained into me to not want to go to that place where I want to take care of myself, you know?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So how is it that loving kindness for ourselves doesn't turn into, let's call it self-obsession, another self-obsession, or self-cherishing in that way? Or I want to even put in just another psychological dig. Archaeological psychological dig. Does that make sense to anyone? You know what I'm talking about? You know, like, how can I just get into me, my history and my stuff, and like, what's made me unhappy and what would make me happy, and you know, all that stuff. So how is this loving kindness practice different from that? I'm sorry. We're learning a different way to do it. Yeah. We're learning a different way to do it. And
for me, I don't think that I really deeply know what my life would look like to be happy, to wish love and happiness and well-being for myself. This is like, I'm doing these practices and it's like, I'm discovering and almost having to spend time thinking about what would my mind be like if I was happy, you know, or
mm-hmm.
what would my emotions feel like? What would my day look like? What would my relationships look like? Because, yeah, like I don't know really the true extent. Like I could maybe start wishing it for other people and envisioning it for other people. But just starting that process for myself, I don't really think that I know. I think maybe I've created the causes to be about as happy as I am in my life up to now, but I don't know how to create the causes
mm-hmm.
to be really, really happy. So wishing that for myself is work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
yeah.
just like, oh, I sit down and feel good about myself. It's like, what would my happiness look like? That's not self-cherishing, you know? Like, what would that be? And then wishing that, like, may I...
Mm-hmm.
May embody that in my mind and my speech.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. So, yeah.
For myself, all my life, pretty much everywhere I go and anything I get into, it's pretty much to learn some tools
mm-hmm.
to in turn do acts of kindness for others.
Absolutely.
To interact with others better. In a manipulative, not manipulative, I guess it's manipulative, I suppose. That's the wrong word for it. To have them like me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I don't have the ability to like myself.
Right.
It's basically to put on a facade.
Yeah.
To basically, because every human being wants to be liked in this world.
Yeah, that's
and
absolutely
so therefore
true.
You can have
yeah.
your tools all set up and you can go out and put on a show for this person or that person and so forth and so on, then you get that like.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that all the more
mm-hmm.
because you're still suffering inside.
Right.
And this concept of actually working on oneself is my question to you about that. Is the Vipassana the best way to go on diving into it to find these things, or this, you talk about counseling and stuff like that, what's the best way to go?
Well, from my point of view, it's different for every person. And I think that doing this practice of love and kindness and doing it daily is huge. And it's a great way to start. And then have a therapist to work with. I don't think it's an either or. I think the most powerful way to do it is both. Like you're doing the loving kindness practice and you start to notice what arises. and you start to be with it, and it starts to switch.
It's a brick wall.
Pardon?
What comes up is a brick wall.
Yeah. So that's what we'll go through. And then, again, we'll go through a little bit about how to work with the brick wall. And we're also going to talk, because I want to talk about it all at once, and I can't quite talk about it all at the same time, which is, what do we do when we feel like it's not working? Like, when it just feels like the brick wall is a perfect thing, because it's that feeling of there's nothing that breaks through, there's nothing that melts it, it's just hard, 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 right? Yeah.
And that's normal.
Pardon?
The feeling's normal when it's not working.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'll shut up now.
Thanks.
I don't think she meant it that way.
No, I didn't mean it that way. No.
Like I said, brick wall.
Yeah.
Therefore, I think if that is normal, that's why it's so difficult to explore, because it's like an unknown territory.
It's right. That's kind of what, like what Ryan was saying. It's this is not having the brick wall is normal. How it's unexplored territory, it's hard work. I mean, I swear, you just think that if you said, hey, we're going to do a loving kindness meditation towards ourselves, it would be the sweetest thing in the world, and we'd all sit around and go, wow, this feels good. But no, it's like the hardest thing in the world. It feels like, okay, I'm going to shoot that second arrow, as the Buddha called it, and not only am I going to try and do loving kindness, and it's going to be work, I'm going to start really criticizing myself for the fact that I can't do it, right? Like, and judging myself and getting pissed off at myself because I can't even do loving kindness. What a loser I am, you know? So I'm joking in a way, but I'm not joking. I mean, I'm saying it in a funny way, but I'm really pointing at a cycle that's hard and it's painful. And what I would say, I'm sorry.
No,
ahead. You're like, well, I can see, go ahead, go.
I find that there's a cycle that is actually helpful, and, mm-hmm. and that you know, by doing things that, you know, are of service or, you know, generous or things like that, that and I'm not expecting anything returned from others, but mm-hmm. but I see, I mean, you can do, you know, good things for other people without them even being aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, and from doing those things, I feel that sort of, you know, cracks the shell a little bit.
Yeah.
And it helps me get through that self-loathing issue.
Right.
And it's like, oh, there is goodness here. And that fuels to be able to turn
awesome.
That back out again.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is this loop that goes on.
Absolutely, that's true. Yeah.
So when you said self-interest, like that's, of course it's self-interest. We do it in order to crack our own walls. So at what point does it become not? I mean, once we reach enlightenment.
Well, what happens is that we do the best we can working with what we have, right? And what I like to say is eventually we figure out that it's a perfect system, that serving others is the highest service to ourselves. And the highest service to ourselves is serving others, because we're so intimately connected that truly we can't separate them, and the separation is false. So part of it is we muster what motivation we can, right? And so the motivation is, this is what I would say about the difference between, it comes back in part to intention, right, and motivation. So why, I've got so many different, it's one of these times, like, different directions. So first of all, to go back, if I think of everything as really ultimately what I want to be able to do is selflessly, happily serve others, and that's going to make me the happiest thing, the happiest in the world, is doing right and doing well by others. What, when I look around, here's one way to think about it, what's an epidemic we have in our world? Depression, anxiety, often inexorably linked to this sense of self-worth, lack of self-worth, right? I myself have a sense of self-worth. If I could figure out how to break or melt that brick wall and really have a sense of touching that with warmth and beginning to learn to give myself loving kindness, then I can teach that to others and help them not do it, not, you know, get some relief from that suffering of lack of self-worth.
So what I hear you say is balance it out with service to others and taking care of yourself, because it's so easy to just go one way or the other. And towards yourself, it feels selfish. Towards others, you eventually run out of energy, so you have to do both.
Yeah, let me get back to that. Hold that for 1 second, and then I'm going to get to that, because that kind of comes with Jeremy's question.
It seems like this is cultivating the heart.
Yeah.
To use different words, and then the heart doesn't discriminate.
Exactly.
If it's... is doing things for others, but then there's a quality of love that's missing, which the practice can generate.
Thank you. That's a beautiful way to put it.
And then this, it's not about what you do, but what...
Right.
Right?
Right.
And then the heart just opens and does what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't take doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a... So thanks. That's wrapping perfectly back into this idea that this is where it's different from psychology. This is where it's different from another self-obsession and self-cherishing, is the motivation is to cultivate and open the heart both ways, right? And this is the context that we're practicing in. So one of the differences is the context. And the context that we're doing the metta for is in the whole four immeasurables. It's not isolated. So one of the things that's happening is we're talking about it in an isolated way because we're focusing in it, but it's not. It's the whole thing, the whole practice is how we're going to open our hearts, how we're going to cultivate this love that's immeasurable towards all living beings, including ourselves. Right? So when we can say, right now I'm cultivating it by giving to others and serving others. Right now I'm cultivating it in this way. And eventually, it's just an open heart. So that context is really, really important, that we're doing it in the context of the four immeasurables and the sense of it being a heart opening, heart cultivating practice. The second thing is, as we go through the practice, right now we're in step one, but what we're going to do is move on to feeling that same loving kindness towards a neutral being, towards someone we really love, towards someone who's neutral, and someone who is a troublemaker or traditionally called an enemy or a challenging person. So that's just in the metta practice. And then beyond that, we're going to go on to the other three immeasurables, right, of compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. And in the midst of all that, if we look at the very first definition, we talk about happiness and the causes of happiness, removing suffering and the causes of suffering. That we could spend a whole another 6 weeks on. What do we mean by the causes? But that's the context, right? So we're not just saying, I want to give you the immediate happiness of a donut, which is a good thing to give, or a meal. It's like, I want to give you the causes of happiness as well. So do you see what I mean? That's that context is what takes it out of self-cherishing and self-absorption. As we're working on this as one method of opening our hearts in a whole bigger picture. And when it begins to feel like, oh, this is self-absorption or self-cherishing, or, you know, I'm focusing too much on myself, scan out to the bigger context and bigger picture. Okay? For instance, the story that came to mind when I was thinking about that is that Alan Wallace was talking about the first Mind and Life conference, and it was one of these times, I think it might have been the time actually, where His Holiness was talking with the Western teachers, and one of them asked, how do you work with self-hatred? Right? And I talked about this last time in this Dalai, and I was like, what's self-hatred? And he's like talking about back and forth with his translator. And then the translator's trying to explain what he means, and he's like, I don't get it. And then finally he got it. And the thing I didn't say last time is he turned around and he looked at all the monks, because there were monks there too, you know, traditional monks. He said, have you experienced this? And he's like, no. Have you experienced this? No. They didn't, maybe I did say this last time, but they didn't actually even understand. Like, they didn't have the experience to relate to this concept of self-hatred and self-loathing. And it was really interesting because what Alan Wallace said, and I was just listening to this, he said, and he was there. You know, this is the report from someone who was in the room at the time. He said that His Holiness was just astonished by the level of shame and aversion and self-loathing that Westerners were talking about. And he asked then all the Western teachers, have you experienced this? And they all went, yes. Yes, I have, you know. And His Holiness said, very puzzled, how can this be when every living being has Buddha nature? How can this be when every living being has Buddha nature? You know? So that story was so important to me because in two things. One, it put together that sense that it's not a universal given, right? We live with it. It's so normal, like you were saying, that we start to take it as a given, and it's not. And the context we work in it is this bigger context of Buddhist understanding that this self, deep self-love, this inner certainty in our, that there does exist an inherent goodness of Buddha nature, our potential awakening, is the basis for this incredible self-esteem and self-appreciation. And that loomed larger for the Tibetan monks than any sense of deficiency or lack of self-worth, right? It was like, yeah, I might have this blip on the screen, but hey, I've got the potential to become a Buddha in this lifetime. And that's so amazing. And the foundation. So how could I have self-hatred towards this being that has the potential for this love? And this goodness and this wisdom and this connectedness and joy, right?
Yeah. Society has helped us to learn that.
Yeah.
We grow up learning how to hate ourselves.
Exactly. And that's what I want to say, like point out, that that's the context that these were taught in, right? And that is something that we do remedially to start to really appreciate. It's like Dasha said, we hear it, but we don't quite believe it yet, right? Like it's not real to us. We don't quite believe. Who was it? Marianne Williamson said, our greatest problem isn't.
I have
no
fear. Actually, yesterday I can add it.
Yeah, yeah.
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate.
Can you read a little louder? I'm having trouble.
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Mm-hmm. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. I read this yesterday.
Yeah.
At the right time.
At the right time. Thank you. Yeah.
I thought you may already have it. So
I didn't have it. No, it just came up. It's something that's so true, right?
It's like this duality between self-hatred, self-loathing, and self-cherishing.
Yeah.
Right? And there's someplace else I think this is pointing at, is saying, let go of both those.
Yeah.
Because denying the self is just as good or just as bad as self-loathing, right?
Right.
It's the other side of the same coin.
Right. Yeah. You
and
can call it self-cherishing. The way I like to say it is that self-loathing is actually just a form of self-cherishing.
Yeah.
It's just a negative self-cherishing. That's all it is. There's no difference. Okay, let's take a break.
Are we doing announcements before the break or after?
We had shifted to doing them before the break.
I'm sorry, I didn't leave the time, I forgot. Go ahead.
No, we do it after.
Let's do it after, because I have a feeling like we need a moment. A moment and some tea and a few snacks, and then we can come back.